Today's case show will be on case 19 in the Book of Serenity. Case 19 is Yunmen's Sumeru. Introduction. I have always admired the novel devices of Yunmen. All his life, he pulled out nails and wedges for people. Why did he sometimes open the door and set out a bowl of glue or dig a pitfall in the middle of the road? Try to discern. A monk asked Yunmen, when not producing a thought, is there any fault or not? Yunmen said, Mount Sumeru. Okay, verse. Not producing a single thought, Mount Sumeru. Yunmen's gift of teaching is not stingy in intent. If you come with acceptance, he imparts with both hands. If you go on doubting, it's so high you can't get a hold. The blue ocean is wide. The white clouds are peaceful. Don't put so much as the tip of a hair in there. A phony cock crow can't fool me. I still won't agree to let you pass through the gate in the confusion. So thank you all very much for coming to practice today. And also for sitting so well this morning. I'm still kind of amazed at how effective this mode of practicing together really is. People sit so well and so determinedly and so wholeheartedly. It's really wonderful to see. Of course, it's mutually reinforcing, right? I mean, So, you know, everybody else can look up from time to time at the screen and you see that everybody's working very hard, everybody's sitting very still. And then if your energies are flagging, if your legs are hurting or you're tired, you know, that gives you more, reassurance, you could say, and provides a little extra reinforcement, right? And that's so valuable, right? Very few of us could do this on our own, right? I mean, it's just probably not possible. That collective energy is magical. So today's Teisho is simple in its formula. A monk asks Yunmen, when not producing a single thought, is there any fault or not? Yunmen said, Mount Sumeru. So, I mean, we all understand that when we sit down to meditate, right? The first stage in meditation practice is just getting into samadhi. It's so challenging for many people. So, you sit down on the cushion if you're a beginner and, you know, you start watching the breath and often there's like immediate relief, immediate. It's like, people who have never done this before will start sitting and within 10 or 15 minutes they feel better. That's quite common. But then, of course, our sits are not 10 or 15 minutes long. They're usually 35 minutes. So those same people begin to have some difficulty. And only part of the difficulty is with their legs, right? They begin to have lots of thoughts. So, you know, when you sit down on the cushion at first and you're watching the breath, it's all very novel. Sometimes the thoughts are just overwhelming, but sometimes there's an interval where you begin to get the point. You know, you begin to feel like, oh, this is interesting, right? And also, if you just sit still and watch your breath for 15 minutes, you're going to have a deep relaxation response. You know, so all of a sudden you'll feel your stress go away. But then the thoughts come back, right? And you're struggling with your thoughts. And And, you know, the sit ends with, you know, sometimes if you're a beginner, your mind overwhelmed with thoughts. And the next time you come back to the cushion, if you do come back to the cushion, it's the same thing, right? So it's very challenging, very difficult to get into samadhi at all, right? But eventually, you know, we begin to get into samadhi. We begin to have those thoughtless states, entering those thoughtless states. And we might begin to say, oh, this is better. Finally, all my hard work is paid off. I'm entering a thoughtless state. So the koan is really coming from somebody who's maybe a little proud of having reached that state, and comes in to see Yunmen. And Yunmen, instead of saying, oh, I mean, if somebody came into me and said, you know, I can't believe what's just happened. I've been sitting for half an hour and there hasn't been a thought in my head. I think I would say, oh, that's wonderful. Isn't that a wonderful feeling? But Yunmen, instead of saying, oh, that's wonderful, and when the guy says, is there any fault or not, Yunmen says, Sumeru. See? And one of the key words here is fault, right? Fault. So, you know, the student is worried about making mistakes and being at fault, see? And so maybe if Yunmen had said, oh, very good, wonderful, no fault, he really wouldn't have helped the student. You know, it really wouldn't have helped the student to get to a better place. You know, saying you're not at fault doesn't solve the problem. The problem is maybe that you're feeling so guilty all the time, or you're feeling at fault. You know, yesterday we talked about another koan where Linji went to see his teacher, Wangbo, Rinzai and Obaku. And Linji went to see Wangbo as a novice, and Wangbo hit him with a stick. And then he went to see him again, and Wangbo hit him with a stick. And the third time he hit him with a stick. And I said yesterday, I don't believe in hitting people with sticks. But the interesting thing is that Linji felt that he deserved it. He felt he felt guilty. He felt that he was to blame somehow, right? And then he quit. He was so discouraged, and he felt so inferior that he went to study with another teacher. The fact that Obaku, Wangbo, hit him could mean many different things. You know, if somebody hits you on the street, it's not your fault. There's no reason you should feel guilty, right? But the fact that that Linji felt guilty, I said, is a sign that he had lost a kind of elemental trust, right? A kind of basic trust, maybe long before he had ever met Obaku, right? So this koan is picking up on that a little bit, right? This is a monk asked Yunmen, when not producing a single thought, is there any fault or not? Any fault, see? I'm not thinking any thoughts now. Am I free from fault? You know, I'm still feeling guilty. I'm still feeling guilty. I'm still feeling, you know, like there's something wrong with me. Now that I'm not having any thoughts, is there anything wrong with me or not? And Yunmen says, Mount Sumeru. And Mount Sumeru is the center of the Buddhist cosmos. And the biggest, the universal mountain. It's this giant mountain. So that's the koan, and that's sort of the issue. You know, before I get to this koan, I want to say a little bit about another koan. It's like two koans for the price of one. everybody here probably is familiar with this other koan, but it's called Gute Raises a Finger. And you know that koan probably. I don't even have to read it. But, I'm sorry, wrong koan. It's called Zuigan Calls Master. Pardon me, forget about the Gute. Zuigan Calls Master. And in the Zuigan Calls Master koan, it goes like this. Zuigan is alone in his zendo. But somehow in the koan, we're able to see what's going on. You know, maybe we're peeking through a window or something, and we see this Zen master, Zuigan. And he's sitting on his cushion, and he's talking to himself. And he says, he's sitting there, and he, all of a sudden he says, "Master." And then there's a silence. And then, you know, maybe in a different voice, the master through Zuigan says, "Yes." And Zuigan in his own voice says, "Master, you know, are you there?" And then in the master's voice, he says, Zuigan says, "Yes, I'm here." And then Zuigan says something like, "Don't let them, you're not going to let them deceive you, are you?" And the master in the master's voice says, "Don't worry, that won't happen." So you know, I think that's a healthy relationship with our big mind. And a healthy relationship with our big mind works like that, you know. So we should be like a little bit like Zuigan and his master. You know, when we sit down on the cushion, the ideal situation is like this. You know, something goes wrong in your life, and you feel out of control, or you feel unhappy. And you sit down on the cushion, and you enter deep mushin, and then you begin to commune with your big mind. And learning how to enter deep mushin is absolutely indispensable, because what we call emptiness, or what we call no mind, or what we call nothingness, those are all just words for our experience of like this blank screen, this blank screen. So, you know, when we sit down on the cushion and we could get into samadhi, and eventually the mind gets blank, we're now facing like a wall. In the story of Bodhidharma, he faced a wall for 9 years. That is called Pikwan, wall stare. But actually, he wasn't facing a physical wall. He wasn't just facing a physical wall. He was sitting in front of that wall that you all know, or most of you know very well. You've been sitting there for, some of you have been sitting there for 30 years, for 10 years at least. You know, when you sit in that blankness, that's the most important place to be, because that's the interface between your big mind and your small mind. And we Zen people know how to get there, and we spend a lot of our lives there. You know, that's where we spend a lot of our time. And at first, that interface is undiscovered, of course. And then eventually it's discovered, but it's an impassable barrier. So those of you who are working with the Mukon may still experience it as an impassable barrier. You're just sitting there in front of this blank wall, this closed door, and you're saying moo, 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 moo. And that can go on for a while. But eventually, something changes in your relationship with that blankness. And what is a door turns into an opening. An opening. My teacher long ago gave me a scroll. It's a copy of a beautiful painting by a Japanese painter named Sesshu. It's kind of a Zen painter. And part of the scroll is this big mountain, this giant mountain. And at the foot of the mountain, there's a door. And in the door, you can see Sesshu has painted little steps. It's like you go through the wall of you go through the opening of this cave, and you go into this cave, and then there's little steps taking you up into the mountain, entering the mountain form. So this is a symbol of sort of what we do when we practice Mu meditation. We're going to that door in the mountain, and we can't at first see the stairs, but that we have to go up those stairs and into the mountain. And at first, as I say, it's just a blank wall. But eventually, it's like every barrier becomes an opening. This is like magic. I don't know if you've ever seen Roadrunner cartoon where Wile E. Coyote is trying to get the Roadrunner, and he takes some chalk and he makes a door in a cliff face. And it's beautifully done, and the Roadrunner just runs through it, and then the coyote tries, and he crashes into it. So, it's a barrier for some, and it's a door for others. But the thing is, you begin to be transformed by that experience. You begin to become different, a different kind of creature. I've known this, but I was just listening again to a podcast. I think it was Radiolab. I don't know if you listen to Radiolab, but I enjoy Radiolab. And they were talking about how difficult it is to program certain kinds of behaviors in robots. And the scientist, the computer scientist said, we thought that it would be easy to program robots to do things like walk across a room, or stick out their arm and drink a glass of water. And he said that we thought the hard things were going to be programming them to play chess or to do, some kind of very complex calculations. He said, but actually it's the other way around. He said, the simple tasks are the hardest tasks for programmers. He said, we've been trying, the programmer said, to simulate eye movements. So we don't even pay attention to our eye movements. We walk into a room, we sometimes consciously direct our sight. But actually, he said, it's incredibly complicated. And he said, it's defied our ability to program. It's so complex, it's so multivariable. And there's so many variables and contexts. And he said, there may be a solution, but we haven't found it yet, just for the way the eye moves. And another person in the story made the point that, most of our mental processing takes place below the level of consciousness. And he said, it's a huge disparity. So much of our processing happens under the level of consciousness, below the surface. And one way to think about that is that when we come to the door of the cave, and it seems like a wall, we haven't learned how to open that up. But when we open that up, we're beginning to be more psychologically flexible, see? We're beginning to be like Zuigon. So, Zuigon has an open door. And so when he goes he's dealing with a problem, he sits down on the cushion, he goes up to that door and he poses his problem to his big mind. And the big mind gives him his instructions, his reassurances. So in the koans, Zuigon's worried about something. He says, Master, Master, are you there? And then the master says, yes, I'm here. And he says, you're not going to let them confuse you, are you? And he says, don't worry, that's not going. The master says, don't worry, that's not going to happen. So, you know, if you ask me what is Zen or what is Buddhism all about, I would say Buddhism is all about having a rich and healthy relationship with our big mind, with the unconscious. And that, you know, most people don't have a healthy relationship with the unconscious. In fact, they might even be terrified of it. But it's, you know, the Buddhist view is that the unconscious is not only highly intelligent, but fundamentally compassionate. That's a little different from a lot of Western psychology, right? You know, the Buddhist view is that inside that, in the mountain, there's a benevolent intelligence, we say Buddha nature, that's trying to help us wake up at all the time. It's there's a wonderful book about this. It's called The Awakening of Faith in the Mahayana. It's a very wonderful, beautiful, classic Buddhist text. And us, maybe in our group, we'll read it someday in our sutra group. But Ashvaghosa, the author of that text, says, you know, don't think that the unconscious mind is neutral or menacing. He says, fundamentally, it's enlightenment itself. It's compassion itself. And it is true, you know, we have all kinds of stuff in there. We have our demons and our dragons and our scary things. But at the core, there's this Buddha mind trying to help us. So all of what we're doing at Sesshin, it takes practice. You have to have practice, and you have to sort of keep up the practice of having an intimate relationship with the master. You know, so Zen practice is interminable in a certain way. You know, you didn't know that when you started, but there may be no stopping, you know. Because, you know, we all, it's hard to trust the master. We easily, as we're growing up, lose that elemental trust, right? And it may be caused by, you know, things in the world, but we internalize it as a failure in ourselves. You know, we internalize, you know, when I was a kid, I lived in Baltimore. And Baltimore was and is a very tough town. And I've said this many times, but much of my early personality was formed by trying to get to school in Baltimore and just not get beaten up, right? And, if you go to school and you get beaten up and you're a helpless little kid, by somewhat older and somewhat less helpless little kids, you know, the strange thing is you internalize it as a problem in yourself, or at least I did. You know, you lose trust in yourself, actually, right? In your fantasy, you should have been big enough and strong enough to beat up those bad boys. And so the problem is you. And you know, and we think that way because we would rather feel ashamed or guilty than feel helpless. You know, we tend to lose our elemental trust in this thing in ourselves as we're growing up. And we have to keep going to the gate, going to the door, and renewing that trust, just like Zuigan, right? We say, you know, Matt, every day when you sit on the cushion, you're really saying with your whole being, Master, are you there? You know, and sometimes, you know the master is there. You feel that energy and you experience that renewal. And that renewal of what? That renewal of your confidence, of your elemental trust. See, this is the trusting mind. The great way is one with the trusting mind. So that's the ideal situation. And that's what we work to cultivate in our lives. See. And please continue to practice that way all your life, and it will never let you down. But sometimes it's complicated, right? Because sometimes things get in the way, right? Things get in the way. And we make mistakes ourselves, and the world doesn't conform to, you know, what we expect. You know, a few summers ago, my sister and her family came up to visit with me from, my sister is a nurse practitioner in Richmond, Virginia. And she has a very difficult job, and I respect her so highly. She works in an oncology ward, you know. So a lot of people she works with aren't going to make it, and some of them do. And she's an excellent nurse. She's really an incredibly compassionate and intelligent and unpretentious person. And I have nothing but the highest respect for my sister. And she came up to visit with me and Barbara. And, you know, we prepared. I had this whole itinerary set up that was going to be this wonderful experience for the whole family, you know. And so, you know, my plan was my sister, because she works so hard, and her kids are kind of like on the computer all day, I thought, well, you need to get these people out into nature. So I planned this whole trip where we would go up into Pennsylvania, north of Stroudsburg, and we would do that rafting trip down to New Hope. Right? I don't know if you're familiar with that, but it's a wonderful experience. You know, you can rent actually kayaks. You know, we're renting kayaks. You can rent kayaks. You can kayak down the river, and it's magical. First of all, you know the river has a pretty strong current. You don't really have to be an athlete to do this. You know, you can cover 12 miles just sort of twirling your oar while it carries you down. So it wasn't challenging for anybody. And also, you know, there's beautiful bird life. You can see eagles, ospreys. You know, sometimes you can see fish in the water. It's really magical. So I planned this trip, and my sister and her two sons, the older of whom is a teenager, right? You know, we all went out on this on these kayaks and Barbara and my sister was in a 1-2-person kayak with her older son, the teenager. And I was in a kayak, Barbara was in a kayak with my sister's other son. And I was in a solitary kayak, right? I was sort of like watching everybody with my own kayak. And the teenager just decided he didn't want to row. Right? So my sister, he's sitting in the back of the kayak and he's just like sulking, right? And my sister is rowing to beat the band, right? It's like, and then at one point my teenager nephew put his foot in the water, sort of like a drag on the water. You know, I wanted to go over there and just, I wanted to hit him with an oar. I just want to row over there and bash him with an oar. You know, he was spoiling everything. And the whole day was like that, right? You know, and my sister, my parents were so strict with us, right? That my sister, I think, needs to sort of like crack down on her sons. You know, they're just totally indulged, right? So I don't have kids, so I don't know what I'm talking about. But my teenage nephew is pretty annoying. Right. And so anyway, we were driving home in the car and we came in two cars. But my teenage nephew, my sister and I were in one car and my wife and the other people were in the other car. And, you know, I was trying to have a conversation with my sister about my brother who passed away many years ago. And it was an important conversation. And this kid kept interrupting us, talking about like he wanted to go to a fast food place, right? I'm really hungry and I want to go to Moe's Mexican food, right? And he kept interrupting and trying to derail the conversation, you know? And I, You know, I actually just let him. I thought, you know, this is not right. You know, he is actually, he's not letting, he wants my sister's attention. And basically he's derailing the conversation, so he makes himself the center of attention. And I felt this was inappropriate, and I just turned and I let him have it. You know, I said, don't interrupt. You know, I didn't scream at him, but I was really firm. I said, it's very rude of you to interrupt us like this. You know, we're trying to have a conversation, and if you want to participate in the conversation, that's acceptable to me, but it's not acceptable to me for you to serially interrupt us like this about something that's not important, you know. So I didn't feel that I had acted out of anger, but my sister was devastated, right? You know, my sister was devastated. So anyway, you know, she's so protective of her children, she felt that I had gone too far, right? You've gone too far, right? You know, he's a sensitive boy and so on. So this is a typical, I would say, this is a typical human situation, right? Typical human situation. And you could sit down on the cushion and say, you know, why, maybe my judgment was wrong. Maybe I should have been more sensitive to my sister's emotional needs, right? You know, my sister's emotional needs. But then, you know, basically, but, you know, he was, you know, trampling on my emotional needs and so on and so on. You can go on and on like this, right? And, you know, we can spend a lot of time going in circles analyzing these things, and we can come away from that experience feeling like we misled ourselves, or our big mind let us down, or we let our big mind down, or we let our sister down, and so on, right? And this tends to undermine our trust in ourselves. This is just one example. You know, I could, you know, sometimes I'm not sure that I was at fault in that conversation. You know, I'm not sure I was at fault, but I have to say that I felt like I was at fault after it was over, you know. And when we feel at fault, you know, we want to do the right thing. And, you know, but if you ask yourself this, you know, was my intention to injure my nephew or to insult my sister or make their time there miserable? You know, I think I can say in my heart that that wasn't my intention. So, you know, this was actually ultimately a wonderful event, believe it or not. You know, because after it was over, my nephew went back to Virginia for a while. But, you know, the next time I saw him, we had a very different rapport, you know. And I don't mean that he was cold and distant. I felt like this event was the thing that really, like, made it possible for us to talk to each other. You know, and my sister probably still feels that I wishes that I hadn't done that. Right? Hadn't done that. But, you know, the next time I saw my nephew, it was like a transformative experience. Maybe that was the first time he had a real encounter with me, right? You know, other than just as his uncle. And it was definitely one of my first times of having a real encounter with him, other than as my nephew. You know, it's like, I never realized he could be such a pain in the ass, you know. So you know, ultimately, I would say that this was a good thing for both of us. You know, that we came out of this, and even if he hadn't talked to me, next time, right? I mean, you know, we're going to go through life, and everything we do is helping us to wake up. That's the Buddhist view. So you know, I didn't choose for these things to happen, but they happened. And, you know, sometimes you can be sitting on the cushion And you can be spinning around in your loops and second guessing yourself. And suddenly they just drop away. It just drops away. And you feel this great opening. I don't know if you've ever had that experience, but when those moments happen, it's really wonderful. It's like, it can be something else. You know, maybe maybe about 10 years ago, there was a job I wanted at Rutgers that I thought I was perfect for. And I went into an interview, and I came out of the interview, and I remember going home and thinking, I think I've got it. I think I've got it. It's in the bag, right? You know, it was such a great interview, and I didn't get it, you know. So I have to say, I would not be telling you the truth if I said, well, I'm a Zen teacher. Nothing bothers me. You know, bothered me. You know, I sat down on the cushion and, you know, I did a lot of sitting with this. And, you know, I think I went through every question in the interview, right? I went through all the questions in the interview and how I answered them. And then I thought about, you know, maybe other things. And, you know, at some point it just all lifted. And, you know, it was just like, this is the it sounds a little corny to put it this way, but this is the adventure of being alive. This is the adventure of being alive. It's like when you realize these things happen to everyone and you feel in your heart, this is how wonderful to be alive. You know, all of this is part of living, being alive, and how wonderful it is to be alive. It's like, you know, you're closed up and suddenly you open up. And there, it's like open in all directions, you know. And that is not a compensatory fantasy, in my opinion. You know, that's a glimpse of a deeper reality. You know, there's a wonderful play in English. You probably had to read it in high school before you were ready for it. You know, it's called Hamlet, and you probably had to read Hamlet, and you probably thought, what the hell is that all about, right? But it's about a guy who can't trust himself. It's about a person who can't trust himself. He second guesses himself all the time. Why they give this to teenagers, I don't know, because teenagers don't second guess it. You know, it's adults who second, it's really a play for adults. This, you know, Hamlet can't do anything without questioning his own motives. So no matter what, and he's so insecure about himself that he can't even, he thinks his father is murdered, but he's not sure. So he thinks, I think dad was murdered, but how do I know I'm right? What if I'm wrong? And he goes in these circles, right, through the whole play. It's maddening. But, you know, at the end, Hamlet just decides, he enters that place, right? He encounters Mount Sumeru. And he says, it doesn't, you know, things are working out as they have to work out. The way he puts it is, he says, there's a divinity that shapes our ends, rough hewn though they may be, right? It looks crazy. It's things are falling off the wagon right and left. But there's a kind of order here. There's a kind of order emerging here all the time. And you know, when we get outside of ourselves and we begin to experience that greater order, that this is the adventure of being alive, you know, that's liberation. That's when we have fused with the big mind. We fused with we've met the master, you know, we've met the master. And, you know, we all have, it's possible to live life and think, oh, if only I'd done that. But of course, you couldn't have done that. You didn't know. You know, in retrospect, you look at something and say, oh, that's the decision I should have made. But nobody on earth in your shoes could have made that decision. You know, and so one can be tormented by one's decisions. One can be pulled apart by doubt. But, you know, when you can encounter the master face, when you can encounter Sumeru in yourself, you realize I've done my best, or and I've made mistakes, you know, I made mistakes. But, you know, this is the adventure of being alive. And you can say the adventure of being alive, but when you're in that place, you know, you feel even your mistakes have connected you to the world. Even my mistakes have connected me to others. You know, how precious they are. You know, now that's, I would say that's trust. I would say that's elemental trust, right? Everything is helping me wake up. So, you know, we're in a time right now where elemental trust is falling, you know, it's a lot not to trust. And, you know, we take it personally in the way that we feel guilty for the failure of many things, not just our own mistakes, right? On a subtle level. So it's so important to, especially now, to go to the door of that cave and prepare to walk up Mount Sumeru from the inside. So please do that in the day, today and in the coming days. A monk asked Yunmen, I always admire the devices of Yunmen. All his life he pulled out nails and wedges for people. Why did he sometimes open the door and set out a bowl of glue or dig a pitfall in the middle of the road? In other words, you know, Yunmen spent his life helping other people. He pulled out the nails that they couldn't pull out. And you know, in other words, he helped them with their obstacles. But sometimes he would set out a bowl of glue, right? Like, this looks good. People would get stuck in the glue, and sometimes he'd dig a hole in the middle of the road. Why did he do that? You know, that's just like Wang Bo hitting Lin Ji. You know, it's not personal, right? It feels personal until you can come face to face with Sumeru. And then it's the adventure of being alive. It's just everything connects you to Sumeru. Everything connects you to Sumeru. Everything is helping you wake up. A monk asked Yunmen, when not producing a single thought, is there any fault or not? Yunmen said, Sumeru. Not producing a single thought, Mount Sumeru, Yunmen's gift of teaching, is not stingy in its intent. If you come with acceptance, he imparts with both hands. If you go on doubting, it's so high you can't get a hold. The blue ocean is wide, the white clouds are peaceful. Don't put so much as a tip of a hair in there. A phony cockcrow can hardly fool me. I still won't agree to let you pass through the gate in the confusion.